Well, greetings to all of you. Good to be together this morning. And the passage today is from James chapter 4. And I invite you to just turn there right away. James chapter 4. You know, looking over verses 11 and 12, which is the next part of the selection that we have in our series through the book of James, at first sight, I thought, you know, there's not a lot here to talk about. On second and third and maybe fourth or fifth sight, it became obvious that there was more than what initially meets the eye. And I began to realize that verses 11 and 12 actually come right within a theme, a general theme that we find throughout the book of James. And if we remember back over a number of previous sermons, we'll remember that theme. So just go back with me a little bit, thinking back into James 1. And you might just turn there, James 1, verse 19, where James said, "Be swift to hear, slow to speak, slow to wrath. For the wrath of man worketh not the righteousness of God." Here we have this idea of speech being a part of being a doer of the word. I think it was Brother Benny that talked to us about this. And so how we talk, whether we talk or don't talk, has something to do with how we keep the Word of God, or how we are obedient to the Word of God. And then looking at chapter 2, we have the passage on partiality, or having respect for other people. And here again, speech comes up. You know, we talk to people and we indicate how we feel about them. And we can do a lot of damage with our words, or we can be affirming and encouraging. So again, this idea of how we can use our tongue, or how we can use our speech to get along with other people. Maybe a way to identify this theme is simply to say it's the getting along theme in James. So on one hand, we're swift to hear, slow to speak, and then we are not partial. Instead, we treat everyone fairly. And now, chapter 3, about controlling the tongue. A lot of familiar territory, a lot of familiar verses here about controlling our tongue. And then, even the section on wisdom at the end of the chapter, verses 13 to 18 in chapter 3, talk about getting along with each other. I mean, it's the wisdom that's from above that is peaceable and allows us to work well with each other. And then Brother Duane talked to us last Sunday about this quarreling and fighting that comes from having these desires that can easily become demands, and then we get angry and fight and quarrel when they're not fulfilled. So that passage is capped, you might say, by these two verses in James chapter 11 and 12. It's sort of like James can't leave this topic alone. He can't leave this topic alone. He has to come back to our speech, to the things that we say, and help us to see how incredibly important they are. Let's read James 4, 11 and 12. "Speak not evil one of another, brethren. He that speaketh evil of his brother and judgeth his brother speaketh evil of the law and judgeth the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art a doer of the law." I'm sorry, "thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. There is one lawgiver who is able to save and to destroy. Who art thou that judgest another? Or some translations say, who art thou that judgest thy neighbor? And so today I'd like us to consider the title of the message, Don't Slander, Rather Speak the Truth in Love. Don't slander, speak the truth in love. I want to work through these two verses point by point. You know, it's interesting that our word for devil is actually connected to the word slander. Now, some of you may know a little Spanish, and if I remember correctly, the word for devil is diablo, which is also the Greek, it's similar to the Greek word for devil. Diabolos is the transliteration. And in short, it means slanderous. It's slanderous. The devil, the slanderer. In Revelation 12, I think it talks about the accuser of the brethren. And being an accuser of people, falsely accusing people, is essentially what slandering is. So he starts out here, speak not evil one of another. So the word speak and evil, actually, the Greek word is katalaleo. I found that is actually kind of a word that sounds sort of like what it means. And so it sounds like somebody that's babbling or saying foolish talk. Katalaleo simply means to speak against somebody, to criminate, to condemn. So that is what he's asking us not to do. Then he's, look at what he's, who he's speaking to. Speak not evil one of another, brethren. So this gives the thought that we're actually talking about people in the church. We're talking about people that are certainly Christians, but he's encouraging them not to speak evil of each other. Now, you may say, that's just not something that should be happening in church, and of course it should not. And you know, I spent a good bit of time thinking, why am I talking about this? I mean, do we have trouble? Do we have trouble slandering? You know, what situations am I thinking of? And I just, to be very frank, I had trouble thinking of situations that impacted me. I thought of some things, you know, as I spent more time studying, but it wasn't something that just quickly came to the surface and I thought of 10 slanderers around here. You know, I think this is a very serious sin. It is actually taking a person and defaming them, talking evilly about them, saying things about them that are unkind, that are not nice. And it's happening here. He's saying this in the context of the brotherhood. Well, let's go on. He that speaketh evil, here again that word, slanderer, he that slanders his brother, again, the context is church, and now we have a new word, judgeth. So it's like he adds just another way of thinking about this. By slandering or talking falsely about somebody, we are actually putting ourselves in the place of a judge. Because judge here means simply that, to make an opinion on right or wrong, concerning something that's right or wrong. In the same way that you would summon someone to trial, and they would be placed before the judge. So it's exactly what we would think it means here. But he says, if you judge his brother, you're actually speaking evil or slandering the law. Okay, so this sounds like it's more serious. Now, let's remember the audience. James' audience was primarily Jewish, and they would have had very high respect for the law, for Yahweh, the giver of the law. So when he says, you're judging the law, let's continue, and I'll come back with a comment on that. Judgeth his brother, speaketh evil of the law, or slanders the law, and judges the law. But if thou judge the law, thou art not a doer of the law, but a judge. So maybe to say this another way, we're simply saying that if we speak evil of somebody, we are actually putting ourselves in place of the law. In other words, we're actually attempting to say what the law is. We're attempting to be the lawgiver and say that someone else is doing something wrong when in fact they may not be doing something that's wrong. So that's how we judge the law, or we slander the law. We put the law down is another way to say that. We're actually not a doer of the law, because at that point we're thinking about somebody else and how they may be a problem. We're not thinking of ourselves and how our lives are lining up with the law. So it's like a shift of focus that happens here. We begin to look at other people, criticize, rather than looking at the law, seeing what it says, and asking ourselves, are we doing it? Which, of course, is the posture that Brother Dwayne talked about before. And that's the wisdom that's peaceable and easy to be entreated. It's thinking about, what does the word say? Am I lining up with it? How can I change? That's one posture. The other posture is looking around and saying, somebody else is not doing that, or trying to deface someone else. So who's this lawgiver? Well, it's obviously God. He's the one that's able to save or destroy. And there's no one in church here that's able to save. Now, we can hasten the destroying process. But we don't have the right, ultimately, to destroy and to save, to give life, to take life. That's God's alone. And so the implication is here, there's one lawgiver, it is God, it's not us, so why are we judging somebody else? We didn't make the law. Let's stop imagining that we are the lawgiver. So that's a short exposition of the passage. We might ask, what is slander? I've hinted at it already. Slander is simply the uttering false charges or misrepresentations that defame and damage another's reputation. You could say it's a false and defamatory oral statement about a person. Here's my simpler definition. Slander is speaking evil of somebody, whether it's behind their back or to their face. Whether you're talking to them face to face, or whether you are talking about them behind their back or away from their presence. If it's derogatory, trying to tear them down, it's slander. Here are some synonyms for the word slander. To tarnish, to malign, to vilify, to sully, to insult, to smear, to belittle, to mock, to denigrate. How is gossip and slander, how are those two related? Well, they are they're closely related. Gossip tends to have more of a connotation where there are people sitting around in the break room at work, right, and just need something to talk about, so the topic quickly goes to negative things about everybody else. So it's more of the chit-chat, gossipy type of thing. Slander, it seems to be a little more intentional, where there's actually bad that is given about somebody, and it tarnishes their reputation or their character. Let's think about some scriptures and some examples from the Bible that refer to slander. Think about Potiphar's wife. Actually, we could go all the way back to the creation. Think about the Garden of Eden. The serpent in the Garden of Eden slandered God. It's basically said something completely false about God. He had Eve question. He said, hath God said? So here we have the devil living up to his name from the very beginning. The very beginning of the garden. We have Potiphar's wife lying about Joseph in Genesis 39. We have the nation of Israel. They're speaking against their leaders in Numbers 14. Israel spoke evil against Moses and Aaron. This was when the giants were in the land, and the spies, I guess they were called, the spies came back with this bad report, and people just rebelled against Moses and Aaron. They said things like, why don't we go back to Egypt? Why are these leaders bringing us out here? So, speaking very disrespectfully about the leaders who had given themselves for the people. We have Ahab and Jezebel taking Naboth's vineyard in 1 Kings 21. And you know the story about Jezebel. She writes up letters. So here we have slander at its height. Ends in the death of Naboth. The ninth commandment. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor, Exodus 20:16. Here are some more verses. Proverbs 10:18, he that hideth hatred with lying lips, and he that uttereth a slander is a fool. The Lord hates six things. In fact, seven are detestable to him. Arrogant eyes, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that plots wicked schemes, feet that are eager to run to evil, a lying witness who gives false testimony, and one who stirs up trouble among brothers. The last phrase is one that probably makes my conscience smart more than any of these. And probably what is the way we would explain trouble in a brotherhood. Somebody who stirs up trouble. So, another verse, 1 Peter 2:1. Put away all malice and all deceit and hypocrisy and envy and all slander. Malice is trying to intentionally harm somebody or to cause somebody trouble. So, are we guilty? Are we guilty of slander? I don't know. Let's see. One of the first things I thought of comes out of my own experience, and probably the part of my life that I'm most involved with right now, and that is my family. And I just became aware that families are places where slander can become very alive. Parents can model slander, and I'm realizing that I need some help here. It's so easy to lash out in disapproval when children make mistakes. Ephesians talks about fathers not provoking their children to anger or not frustrating them. Rather, bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord, or another translation, discipline and instruction of the Lord. So, how do parents relate to disrespect and disobedience in their homes? They can either relate to them in ways that grows up children, causes them to think about what they've done, and helps them to come under the authority of their parents. Or they can do it in another way that frustrates and actually models slanderous behavior. So on one hand, there is disrespectful talk, bad mouth, back talk. So how do parents respond? Well, most parents understand that that's not right. Most children do too. And so parents can, and many times do, lash out in anger. Because it's not right. This is not right. It's not the behavior that we want in our families. And there's every righteous reason in the Bible for why we should be righteously angry. So we can approach it with yelling, with talking, trying to out-talk, we can out-argue, we can do other punishments, things like that to try to make the punishment worse, make the pain worse than the bad talk, the defiant spirit that we see. Slander, again, remember, is speaking evil of someone. What my realization is that my talk to my children can actually be classed sometimes as speaking evil. Because I can talk to them in tones of voice. I can talk to them in a way that belittles their character, belittles their identity as a person, rather than calling them to grow up in the nurture and obedience of Christ. So is behavior like that wrong? Most certainly. Does it need to be addressed? Of course. Do we ignore it? Absolutely not. But we approach it not out of our anger. Instead, we approach it out of love and concern. Do we give consequences? Absolutely. Do we give firm consequences? Of course. Are they severe sometimes? Yes. But we do it in love. Actually, that's the definition of love, is reaching out to do whatever it takes to care for our families. When we address disrespect and disobedience with shouting, glaring looks, and words of condemnation, rather than dealing coolly and decisively with disobedience and disrespect in our families, then we're modeling how to relate in slanderous ways. Those who are less mature often suffer from slander. And we think of the passage that Jesus talked about it being an offense to a little one, or those that are less mature, we could say, it were better that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were drowned in the depth of the sea. In other words, if you're going to offend little children, why don't you just, be better if you weren't around. Be better if you weren't around. Now, I have to say, it's offending little children as well if you don't deal with their disrespectful behavior. So, we could look at it that way, too. Another way that parents can model slander is simply talking disrespectfully about other people. So, especially authorities, people who have responsibility, whenever we talk disrespectfully, I think even terms that we use, I'm not sure about the word. For example, the word cop is used today. It's not, probably not as derogatory as it would have been a generation ago. I'm not sure. But I think something as simple as teaching our children the word policeman or policewoman as they are today, but teaching them a respectable term, rather than saying, and there are other names too that could be used for law enforcement officers that are derogatory. If we find ourselves using those types of things, we're setting up our children for making slanderous comments and not really knowing it, not understanding that they are slandering. Using respectful terminology is one way that we can teach this respectful talk to our children. Parents also get into trouble when they're double-faced. And our children see through this quickly. When we have negative and scolding talk to our children at home, and then suddenly somebody walks in the door and we're pleasant and congenial. I've had a few embarrassing moments like that. That's just an opportunity for us to say, whoops, made a fool of myself. And let our children know. Say, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have talked like that. I was out of line. Doesn't hurt dads. It does not hurt dads to make apologies, believe it or not. And then siblings in families can quickly, they can so easily get into the habit of cutting each other down with negative remarks, negative comments about each other. And I think in our families we can actually live with this kind of environment, this kind of atmosphere, and get used to it. And that's the alarming thing, is that our children, us, we, or it could be a school environment, it could be a work environment, it could be any context that you find yourself. If you hear a lot of negative talk, don't let yourself get used to that. The negativity is not a spirit that's from above. From an organizational standpoint, if you're working in business, if you're working in organizations such as a school, if there's a negative spirit, from an administrative standpoint, that has to be dealt with decisively. There's no way that that can be allowed to remain and the organization to continue to blossom and prosper. The negative spirit has to be identified. The person that this is centered around has to be identified. He has to be approached. He has to be talked to. If he is willing to change, fine. If he's not, he has to be dismissed. It's very serious. It just has to be dealt with decisively, or the organization itself will just begin a steady spiral down the tube, so that morale is broken, the effectiveness of the organization becomes very, very minimal. So a negative spirit, these things can start in our families. That's what I'm trying to say. They can start in our families, in places where we find ourselves rubbing shoulders with each other, with people all the time. Adults, of course, we can be guilty talking about other people's sins. And I think this is where it gets really sticky. You know, we all sin. We all do things that are not right. And unfortunately, we have to talk about those things sometimes. We have to talk about the things that we do that are wrong. And we have to talk about other people's sins sometimes. There's a quote from John MacArthur. It's a sermon that I found where he was telling about this conversation that he had. There was a conference of pastors, he says. There was a conference of pastors, and someone told me they were going to discuss me, and they were going to present the things that are wrong with me and so forth. And so I asked what church this was going to take place in, and I called the pastor on the phone. He answered the phone, and I said, "This is John MacArthur. I understand that this evening you're going to have a discussion of me." And it got kind of silent on the other end, I confess, but I said to him, "I just want you to know that I'd be more than happy to be there and answer any questions that anybody would have. I certainly would be more than willing to just stand there at a microphone and let anybody ask anything they wanted and do the best I could to answer truthfully what's really in my heart and what I really believe. If that would help you come to some meaningful conclusion about me, I would be more than happy to do that." His reply was, "Absolutely not. We could never allow that." And then he goes on to say, "See, that would spoil the party because the thing thrives on the absence of the person being slandered." So one of the ways to avoid slander is to simply bring in the people that we're talking to. Bring them in and talk to them face to face. So slander is not, let's talk about a couple things slander is not. Slander is not talking about somebody when they are not present. People do this all the time and we don't mind. I don't mind if you talk about me in nice ways when you go home today. That would kind of gratify me, I suppose. We don't mind when people talk about us. That's not slander. And even if somebody was talking about a fault that we have, you know, let's say there's an idiosyncrasy that I have. I tell you, I have one. If I'm speaking public and get a little nervous, I can scratch the top of my head. All right, so if you happen to see me do that today and talked about it at lunch today, I probably wouldn't lose much sleep over that, especially since I already know I do it. But those kinds of things are not slander. It's not necessarily slander to talk about somebody's problems. If we are sharing because that person is part of the problem and a part of the solution. And we can think quickly of Matthew 18, where you bring one person in, and the person you want to talk to, you talk to them, the one you want to approach, the one you want to give feedback to or encouragement to. And then if they don't listen, if you get no response, you bring somebody else. Bring another mature Christian brother. And then finally, bring it to the church, where you have a group of, hopefully, mature Christian people who are helping to give input into the situation. And that brings us to that first point on your handout. Don't share sensitive information with anyone unless that person is a part of the problem or the solution. I don't know who told me that, but whoever did, when they did, it was like a light bulb moment in my mind in realizing that there are times and places to talk about people and their problems. Here it is. There's always a reason you're talking. It's to bring solution. It's to bring resolution to the problem. Slander is not warning others about a person's sin. When the sin is confirmed, it's public knowledge, or at least as public as the group of people you're working with, and when you present it in a way that shows respect for that person. So I want to just go over briefly the points that I listed on your handout there from John Bloom on his blog, Desiring God. Comments on stopping slander. And so he says, so how do we do this? The best way to stop slander is to become people who are not safe to slander around. We must ask each other questions like, and so imagine yourself sitting down with somebody and you're just getting ready to hear some things. And they promise to be interesting, right? And so you can ask right away, have you shared your concern with the person directly? That's such a good thing to ask. And to volunteer to go with them and talk with the person. So what you're telling them is that, you know what, I don't have time to hear what you're going to say unless you're willing to do something about it. See, slander is really cheap. It's the easy way out. It's just about ego. It's about us feeling good about ourselves. Having concern and going to someone directly, that takes time. It takes energy. It takes much more than many of us want to do. Number two. You could say, just to be clear, is this information I should know? Do you want me to help you pursue reconciliation? See, that's the reason why you maybe should know. If you're not going to be a part of the solution, remember, there's really no reason for you to know about this. And they can just stop talking, go talk to the next slanderer they can find. So here what we're doing is we are concerned about relationships. We're concerned about people. And because of that, we can't waste our time listening to a slanderer. Thirdly, are you doing everything you possibly can to put away all bitterness and wrath and anger and clamor and slander? This is from Ephesians 4:31. Here we're trying to help the person see that they are responsible. They have a responsibility. It doesn't matter if they've been sinned against or not. They still have a responsibility in how they will respond to that sin. Fourthly, how can I help you guard this person's reputation like a treasure? Here we're talking about motivation. We're talking about a person's motivation for bringing this to you in the first place. Are you bringing this to me because you care about this other person and you want to bring resolution? Or are you coming to me because you want to vent and make yourself feel better? And then he goes on to say, in other words, friends don't let friends slander. Friends don't let friends act like God haters. The more we love people, the more we hate slander, because a slanderer hates his victims. Go on next, though. I've always been puzzled about slandering and trying to find help in very difficult situations. Probably all of us if we haven't already, we will be in these situations where you have information that's given to you. And the question is, what do you do with it? Because sometimes you are given information in a very confidential way. So the first grade version of this is something like this. Okay, I'll tell you a secret. If you promise not to tell anybody. And of course, we all want to hear the secret, right? So we promise. And then if we're not very conscientious about it, we just say something like, oh, I have my fingers crossed in my pocket or something like that. And go ahead and do what we want to do. Or we live bound to that for the next 100 years and, you know, feel guilty whenever we think about that little secret. My point simply being, as adults, we confide in each other because we want help. We need help. We're relational people. Okay, so that's not a bad thing, to ask for help, to confide, to tell people our problems. That's the church. However, this confidentiality can become a bondage and an incredible trap, where somebody comes to you and says, look, here's this terribly bad sin. I did it. But look, I trust you. I don't trust anybody else. You're the only person I trust. I trust you. Don't you tell anybody. So at that point, in our mind, we're thinking, okay, yeah, I'm trusted. That's a good feeling. Not everybody in this world is. I'm trusted. This person has a lot of confidence in me. And I can see why they don't have much confidence in a lot of other people. Okay, so I will value that and close ourselves off from telling anyone else, it just pushes us right into the same trap that the person who came to us was in the first place. What they need is help. They need somebody to help them with the troubles that they're in, with the sin that they're in. And if you are arrogant enough to think that you're the only one that can help them, then you also need help. What we need to do instead is to tell them that we will treat this as confidentially as best we can. But if there's some reason that needs to go to a broader group of people, we will be doing that. And that needs to be a part of us, our conversation very early on. I think this, especially in counseling situations, I think ministers face this type of thing where they need to realize, and I think they just need to be frank with their congregations. They need to say, we are open to having you come in and help. We want to help you. We want to be advisors for any situations that you need help with. However, if there is sensitive information that comes up that's going to be detrimental to other people, that's going to need a wider audience in order to deal with, then just know that we need to be taking it that direction. And it's for your good. It's for the good of the person, because secrecy doesn't help bring resolution. So let me read through these. I felt like this really helped put together what I felt was important. He says, reporting confirmed, documented sin and abuse to appropriate people in positions of authority who can do something about it. He's suggesting this is not slander. 2, participating as an appropriate person in spiritual and in some cases civil authority in an investigation such as report of someone's sinful, perhaps abusive behavior with an intent of either confronting that person or clearing their good name. 3, discreetly and without unnecessary details, informing others of another's confirmed sinful or abusive behavior because without this knowledge, someone might suffer real harm. Finally, seeking pastoral counsel regarding how to navigate a complex and ambiguous situation, doing everything you can to guard the reputation in question from unnecessary damage. So do you see, even in this, the care, the concern for the reputation of the people that are that are being worked with? And so, speaking the truth in love, this is the antidote to slander. It is the way to resolve slander. I think of a passage in Ephesians where Paul says, verse 11 of chapter 4, and he personally gave to some to be apostles, prophets, evangelists, some pastors and teachers, for the training of the saints in the work of the ministry to build up the body of Christ, until we all reach unity in the faith and in the knowledge of God's Son, growing into a mature man with a stature measured by Christ's fullness. Then we will no longer be children, tossed by the waves and blown around by every wind of teaching, by human cunning with cleverness and the techniques of deceit. But, speaking the truth in love, let us grow in every way into Him who is the head, Christ. From Him, the whole body, fitted and knit together by every supporting ligament, promotes the growth of the body for building up itself in love by the proper working of each individual part. Here's an incredible picture of people who are not spreading slander, talking evilly about each other. Rather, they are working to tell each other about their problems so that the body as a whole gets healthier and healthier, stronger and stronger, more fit, more athletic, more powerful. So can you imagine a church like that where people are looking out for each other and they are trying not to find scabs to pick off, but they are looking for wounds. They're not just ignoring a cut on the hand. They're not just ignoring an ulcer at the stomach. They're not just ignoring dementia setting in. Any disease they are looking at and taking very seriously, because they realize that even something as small as a cut, if it is not bandaged, if it's not taken care of, could produce incredible health challenges. And the health of the entire body is at stake. And they're a part of the body. So we are all a part of this body. If somebody is sick, we're sick. If somebody is a hand and they're weak, we're weak. If somebody is a head and they're tired, we're tired. If somebody has stubbed their toe and we can't run very well, we are all lame. And it's when we look out for each other in those ways that we begin to care deeply about the body of Christ that we are a part of, and we want so badly to bring wholeness to it, not slander. I think of the classic passage in Matthew 7 where Jesus said, "Judge not that ye be not judged, for with what judgment ye judge, it shall be measured to you again." And he gives the visual of the speck in somebody's eye, and you're trying to get that out with this huge plank sticking out of your own eye. I mean, Jesus must have just had to smile in spite of himself. But you know, this is not saying that we don't judge people or critique another person's sinful actions. Rather, we need to do it in a humble and redemptive spirit, understanding that we have blind spots. We have failures. Believe it or not, we have ulterior motives for doing the things we do. We really do need to see people's problems. They need us. We need to work together so that we can all grow. So that takes to the other part of your handout where I say the excuses for not confronting each other. These are all the ones that I find. One is personal guilt. And we're saying things like, "I have a problem too. How could I confront somebody about this?" So personal guilt. Just saying, "I'm not good enough. How could I help anybody?" So that number two, we have unsure judgment. We say things like, "Maybe this isn't as bad as I think. Maybe I don't understand the situation. Maybe I don't know what's going on." And that, let's just say it frankly, that becomes a big lazy bone. It's just a way to say, "Okay, maybe I can get out of this one." Three, fear of rejection. "I'm afraid they won't accept my reproof graciously. This may bring tension into our relationship." Again, this is a cop-out. Look, it's the body that's at stake. If they're sick, I'm sick. Four, lack of concern. It takes time to talk to people. I've got other things to worry about rather than focusing on everybody else's problems. And I'll admit, I'm guilty of this one. You know, and it's not that I go around saying that, but I can very easily say, I've got too much. I'm sinking. I can't get my own stuff done. Man, I can't even mow the lawn. Or whatever it is. You know. So what? I mean, what does it matter? You know, what does matter? And that's the question. What does matter? Is it you and I and the church of Christ, or is it my old yard? Or is it my lesson plan? Or is it my business? Or that one other piece of, you know, that other loaf of bread I want to get out and give to the neighbors? 5, selfishness. And I'm thinking about group dynamic here. I guess I'll let them do what they want to do. I'll let them learn for themselves the consequences of their actions. They're probably not going to listen to me anyway. We need to confront each other more about failures we see in each other. Lack of confrontation in a church shows apathy. It shows that we don't care enough about each other. On the other hand, think about the keen spiritual insight, the exhortation that could be shared around if we would just all talk to each other. If we have a concern, and we all have them. We all have concerns. I mean, just think about it. Who in church here could you think about right now that you say, you know what, I really should talk to them. I don't really like what I think I see. Well, why not talk to them? You won't do it right. You're going to flub up. Fine, but you've started. You can go. You can share. You can say something. And that's how we're going to grow. You know, if I think about, let's imagine, for example, that it's husband and wife. So I'm going to assume that you care deeply for each other. All right? So let's say wife hears husband majorly mispronounce a word. I mean, it would just be embarrassing if he was heard in public saying something like that. Okay, how many wives who care deeply about their husband would just hear him say that at home and not correct him? Of course they would correct him. Not because they're trying to be picky. Simply because they're trying to save him the embarrassment of saying something like that in public and you know, making a fool of himself. If we care about each other here, we're going to think about reproof and exhortation in that way. We're going to think about it as reaching out, trying to help each other and save us pain. I'm trying to save you pain. You're trying to save me pain. We're working together. This is us. It's a body. We are together. And we're trying to work to save each other. So acknowledging our own mistakes when we come to other people helps to give us credibility in speaking to other people's lives. When we confront somebody about worldliness, and maybe we are concerned about improvements they're making on the house, we feel like it's just over the top. Okay? Let's acknowledge our own struggle with worldliness. You know, there are some areas that we're struggling with too. Let's empathize when we are confronting sins of the flesh. Let's acknowledge our tendency to lust. When we're confronting selfishness and pride in somebody, let's note that we have our own pride to deal with and regret its presence in our own hearts. Guidelines for speaking tactfully about sin in each other's lives. Listen more, speak less. It's easy to be forming responses while somebody is talking. And I'm just embarrassed about how many times I do this. I will be forming a response to what you're saying before I even know what you're saying. We can probably identify with it. What it happens is we think we know what's going to be said. We think we know what's going to be said because we understand this person and we know what they think about a certain thing, right? And so we have the whole paragraph before they even said the first sentence. and we already have a response. There it is. And then you interrupt and give it to them. I mean, that's just absurd. But we tend to do that. So don't interrupt. That's a pointer to listen more, speak less. Secondly, learn to know those we want to encourage. What I find is that probably the people that I'm most concerned about are the people that I know the least. Why don't I learn to know them? You know, so why don't I try to understand situations? So I'm going to suggest that relationship is paramount to speaking tactfully about sin in somebody's life. Use the compliment sandwich. This may be trite, but say a compliment and then say what you really want to say and then say the compliment. Well, yes, do that. It's not all bad. Be tactful, be discreet, but go to somebody thinking about what you can say that is good about that person. What do they bring? What strength do they bring? What do you appreciate about them? It's very important that you work through that before you bring in the critique. Guidelines for accepting criticism graciously. So a lot of times we think, okay, people just need to learn how to give criticism. And that's certainly the truth. But guess what? It's probably a better topic to be talking about how to receive graciously criticism. So ask questions that clarify the critique. Be sure you're understanding what's happening. Don't just read the critique that they give at face value and think you know what they're talking about because you know this person and you know the spirit that they would bring this in and on and on and on. Ask clarifying questions. Take this opportunity to sit down with them and learn to know that person better. It's really a lazy way out just to say, okay. And you're getting ready to move and then go enjoy the greater tension that has now moved into your relationship. Instead, ask clarifying questions. Seek to understand. And so seek to understand how you can change. Acknowledge what you can in this accusation. And I may just add, sometimes you may even say, I mean, maybe it is a false accusation. And you say, you know, I don't know. I don't even realize I'm doing this. But you can at least acknowledge that the other person senses this from you. That's a fair acknowledgement. We don't always know ourselves. We don't always know how we come across. We, like I said, we have blind spots. So be willing to say, that must be a blind spot I have. I wasn't aware I was doing that. Thank you for coming and mentioning that to me. Express appreciation for the person caring enough to approach you. Offer to meet again to talk about how you're doing. This should not be the last straw of the relationship. This should be one of the beginning building blocks that's going to draw you closer together. Here is a person who's reached out to you. Thank God. They have actually cared enough about you to reach out to you, and you can use this to build back a relationship. And so, don't slander. Speak the truth in love. We can't afford not to. Let's pray. Father, I want to ask your care over each of us. Thank you that we do have instruction in your word. Thank you that you meet us where we are. You convict us of sin that we have in our life. You help us to understand. Father, sometimes it takes very difficult situations in our life for us to be able to, for us to stop long enough to hear and to understand what you're saying to us. I ask specifically for this church right here, that you would help us to be able to speak truth into each other's lives. Help us to care enough about each other to do that. Help us to have enough heart to be able to take in the concerns of others, to be able to understand, to try to learn, to try to grow. And in all of this, there's a commitment to staying together, to being together, to trying to grow together. And so I ask that you would help us to be committed to each other as well. In Jesus' name, amen.